Hello there. Today is Tuesday, November 7th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, shock and grief in the aftermath of Sunday's horrific mass shooting in a Texas church.
He just hurt so many people, and he just affected so many people's lives.
President Trump continues his Asia trip with more tough talk on North Korea. Kingdom-wide arrest in Saudi Arabia see the crown prince tightening his grip. Also ahead, a creative competition in New York City aiming to fight hunger. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, police say the gunman who killed 26 people at a Texas church appeared to have been motivated by a domestic dispute with his in-laws and had sent threatening text to his mother-in-law before launching Sunday's attack. Texas public safety official Freeman Martin said investigators are searching for the reasons why Devin Kelly, a 26-year-old dishonorably discharged U.S. airman, opened fire on worshipers at a Baptist church in Sutherland Springs. Kelly was stopped by a local resident who heard the mayhem and then, armed with a rifle, went after him. Another man, Johnny Langendorf, who was driving by the church, also heard the gunfire and then, along with the neighbor with the rifle, pursued Kelly as he fled the scene.
The gentleman with the rifle came to my truck as the shooter took off and said that we had to get him, and so that's what I did.
Police believe Kelly may have ultimately died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound in his car.
We know during that pursuit, the suspect used his cell phone to notify his father that he had been shot and didn't think he was going to make it.
According to Pentagon reports, the shooter served in the U.S. Air Force, but it was court-martialed in 2012 for assaulting his wife and child, sentenced to 12 months imprisonment, and then dishonorably discharged from the military. Joining me now to discuss all of this is Los Angeles-based criminal defense attorney David Shapiro. David, so is this a mental health issue? Is this a criminal issue? Is this a gun issue? Gun advocates say it is. What's happening here?
Well, I think it's a little bit of everything, actually a lot of everything. You know, whenever we're dealing with, you know, a constitutional amendment, primarily the Second Amendment, it's a sensitive issue. People believe, whether right or wrong, whether justified or not, you know, that certain political candidates may be willing and able to attack their ability to possess a firearm. So that's one issue. So there's a political component of it, is where politicians don't want to alienate some of their core bases or their core, you know, voter demographics. That's one. There's a big difference, though, between your ability to arm yourself with a revolver or with a firearm in general, as opposed to with an AR-15, mm-hmm. which we've seen in Las Vegas,
right?
Which we've seen in Texas, mm-hmm. which we've seen pretty much, I think, the last four or five mass shootings in this country, AR-15,
right. Yep.
Over and over and over again.
Right, and then that's what this gentleman was using. In fact, he apparently passed a background check in 2016 for the Ruger AR-556, I believe it was.
That is what is most troubling to me, mm-hmm. about this in my line of work as a criminal defense attorney, because so often we are dealing with clients who wind up resolving their case by a plea bargain or conviction, and they are convicted of a domestic violence offense. Now, I practice in the state of California, but what you get convicted of in California will affect your federal rights as it relates to your ability to possess a firearm. So if you're convicted of a domestic violence offense in the state of California, even as a misdemeanor, it is at least a 10-year gun ban in the state of California. And it almost always, if not always, triggers a federal ban on firearms. That's what I advise my clients. You're done with firearms. Big issue practicing in San Diego because of so many military people, and it basically takes your livelihood. How someone could be convicted of a domestic violence offense, and then after the fact, I mean, I can understand if it was a situation where they had the guns in their possession, they might not have been honest about turning them over, or they could have said they don't have them anymore, and then they do this. How someone could, after the fact, legally get any weapon, let alone mm-hmm. an AR-15, mm-hmm. escapes me. And that's what I think, from a political standpoint, I don't understand why we all can't agree on at least enforcing the existing gun laws.
Mm-hmm.
That's the biggest problem here, because you can't mm-hmm. take steps forward, and they should.
Right.
You can't take steps forward if you don't enforce the existing laws on the books.
But didn't the people who sold him the gun enforce the law? He apparently passed a background check.
Well, I don't necessarily, at least what I know at this point, I don't necessarily fault the gun dealers. Mm-hmm. I fault the overall system of lack of having updated mechanisms and means to share this information on their computer, on their end. It may very well said, hey, this person was never convicted of a crime. Now, part of that could have been complicated by the fact that the conviction, my understanding of domestic violence, was in a military tribunal. So there might not have been that overlap. You would think that in 2017, if someone's convicted in state court or in military court or in federal court, that there would be that overlap and everything would just pop up. Unfortunately, it's not the case. And I think that might have been, at least at this point in time, what I know, might have been part of the loophole. But that's just unacceptable for the state of the times that we live in, where you can't figure that out.
The Trump administration has reversed some Obama-era policies regarding people who have mental illness being allowed to purchase guns. I'm not sure where that leaves us as far as the mental health issue with this particular person.
You know, my understanding is, again, that he purchased this firearm before, obviously, some of the Obama-era progressive policies with respect to mental illness and the ability to have access to firearms was scaled back. But, you know, I heard earlier today a lot of people are saying, well, this isn't a gun issue, it's a mental health. Well, it's both. It's a mental health issue in general, that there's not enough funding and these people are not getting treated who have serious issues where there are signs, like a dishonorable discharge, like a domestic violence conviction, like an ongoing beef that apparently this individual had with his in-laws who might have been parishioners at the church. And it's also a gun issue. It's a gun issue linked to a mental health issue. Whereas, you know, now these anybody in California in particular, you get 5150, which is basically you go in for a 2 to 3 day time period and you're hospitalized because of some concerns about your mental illness. You cannot legally buy a firearm in most instances for at least 10 years. You know, so there has to be something there. There has to be some sort of a system. If you're on the no-fly list, if you're on the terror watch list, you can't buy a firearm. If you're diagnosed with a mental illness, you shouldn't be able to get a firearm no matter what state you're in. If you're convicted of a violent offense, even a misdemeanor domestic violence, you should not have access to a firearm.
I can't imagine someone who is willing to take an assault rifle, go into a house of worship, and kill anyone, much less all those children, could be mentally stable.
But the thing is this, if you have the capability... You know, that's the thing. The children are the worst part of this. I mean, everybody, any loss of life is a tragedy, no matter who it is. But we have to understand that how could this person kill children? Well, how could they do what they could do? How could they go in and just fire at anybody? You know, at that point, they're so far gone that whether it's an 18-month-old child, whether it's the parishioners, or whether it's the preacher's daughter, no matter who it is, it doesn't matter to them. And that's what's so sad. But it's also what makes it so scary that these people can have access to firearms and there's nothing that people have done in the past, and there's reluctance to make this quick change to make sure stuff like this doesn't happen again, and it continues to happen over and over again.
All right. Criminal defense attorney David Shapiro, we appreciate it. Meanwhile, authorities say 26 people were killed. They ranged from... from 18 months to 77 years old. 10 of the wounded worshipers remain hospitalized in critical condition. 4 of them are in serious condition, and another 6 have been stabilized or released. And continuing with the conversation about the horrific events in Texas Sunday, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski, who has the social media aspect of all of this. Andrew, I know it certainly has played a big role in events like this.
Social media is playing a very big role in this incident in a number of different ways. Investigators are using social media as a valuable source of information, looking at things like the shooter's Facebook page, seeing that his profile picture was an automatic rifle. There are reports that within recent months, the shooter began friending people in and around the community of Sutherland Springs, Texas, where the shooting took place, and was starting fights with people on social media. That's something that the investigators are going to look into to see how that played into this incident. We're also seeing instances where digital media can help this case, and probably the most prominent of those instances is that the church regularly filmed the service and put it up on YouTube for parishioners that couldn't attend in person. Now, on the day of the shooting on Sunday, they were filming the service, and investigators say they have that video. They're going to use that video as part of their investigation and their fact-finding. but that's something that a lot of people are talking about, saying how horrible must it be to be one of these investigators
kidding.
To watch this video and have to
imagine.
Use that.
I can't even imagine.
It's just terrible. But social media, as good as it is, as helpful as it is in this case, is also hurtful in some instances. And we're seeing a number of instances where social media posts have proven false and spread rumors.
Really?
Starting right after this shooting took place with the incorrect name of the shooter, several cases where people tweeted out a name that was not accurate, false rumors about the suspect's political or religious motivations, some saying that he was targeting conservatives or that he had recently converted to Islam. Both of those have been proven false.
Okay.
And then you're seeing also people using social media not just as a fact-finding instance for this case and a way to spread information, but to mourn the victims. One instance I saw that often repeated on social media is that the youngest victim was just 18 months old, something that a lot of people are talking about. And a lot of people talking about policy and talking about gun control. Even that became a point of contention, some saying that it's being politicized to try to push an agenda of gun control, other people saying it needs to stop, and gun control is the way to stop these massacres from happening in the future. And one stat that plays into that policy debate, after the shooting, the top five deadliest mass shootings in modern U.S. history have now all occurred within the past 10 years. So that's one stat that a lot of people are sharing and saying that's the reason why there needs to be something done, whether it's gun control, whether it's mental health. As President Trump talked about, something needs to be done to stop these events from occurring again and again and again.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. U.S. calls for equal diligence in efforts to combat terror groups in Pakistan. The U.S. Commerce Chief defends the investment in Russian shipper linked to Putin's inner circle. Egyptian rights lawyer says he'll run for president in 2018. And amid the outcry, Afghan officials rescind a temporary ban on WhatsApp and Telegram. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, President Donald Trump is now in South Korea for 2 days as part of a regional tour that has been dominated by North Korea's weapons developments. During the two-day visit, he is expected to reaffirm America's commitment to defending the U.S. ally against Pyongyang amid increasing tensions. And while in Japan, the president criticized the approaches of previous U.S. administrations.
The era of strategic patience is over. Some people said that my rhetoric is very strong. But look what's happened with very weak rhetoric over the last 25 years. Look where we are right now.
Well, he declined to answer a Japanese reporter's question about whether he's prepared to go to war with North Korea. Japan's prime minister, standing alongside the U.S. president, borrowed a phrase from Trump on Monday, agreeing that all options are on the table.
Now is the time, not for dialogue, but for applying maximum level of pressure on North Korea. We completely agreed that in order to make North Korea change their policy, Japan and U.S. must take leadership in closely collaborating with the international community so that we can enhance the pressure to the maximum level over North Korea through all possible means.
Abe revealed that on Tuesday he will announce his country will freeze assets of nearly 36 North Korean groups and individuals. Meanwhile, in Saudi Arabia Saturday, there were unprecedented arrests of scores of princes and ministers once considered untouchable. The kingdom-wide swoop has left international investors shocked and analysts scrambling. Included in the unprecedented roundup was one of the world's richest men, Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, the billionaire businessman who co-owns the Four Seasons hotel chain. But the scale of what's being dubbed by analysts a purge further consolidates the power of the 32-year-old crown prince and future king, who's said the move is aimed at stopping corruption. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Professor Stephen Zunis at the University of San Francisco exactly what is happening here.
Saudi Arabia has been rife with corruption for many years, not surprising given the enormous wealth and the fact that it's virtually held entirely by a single extended family and a few cronies who are in good terms with him. But this purge, while the targeted people may or may not be guilty of various corrupt practices, does appear to be more political in nature. It's an effort of Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, to basically get rid of any potential rivals prior to his coming ascent to power. Traditionally, the Saudi royal family has, well, certainly a family dictatorship by any measure, has had some degree of checks and balances within various factions. But these purges have led some people to suspect that the ambitious crown prince may be eyeing a more direct, personalist rule than we've seen from previous Saudi monarchs.
Are we seeing a new period of autocracy in Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's always been autocratic, but the style of autocracy, if you will, from a more, you know, a collective oligarchic kind of structure to one that is concentrated within a smaller group of people around the crown prince could definitely indicate that we're looking at perhaps a more modern form of authoritarianism.
Are we also seeing a struggle between the conservative traditionalists who rule by consensus and the new, more liberal, younger reformers?
While the crown prince does have some liberalizing ideas in terms of curbing the power of the religious police and some of the more traditional tribal elders, he certainly has some very conservative and indeed reactionary views on a number of other things, and his propensity to use military force in the case of interventions in Yemen and Bahrain and the threats against Qatar is indicative. He doesn't exactly appear to agree with certain international legal norms in terms of international relations. So it's hard to see, you know, where this is going in terms of the overall direction of Saudi Arabia. But I don't think we will necessarily see the emergence of anything that would be more along Western lines or anything that could be reasonably labeled progressive or democratic.
President Trump, on his trip in Asia, tweeted that they, referring to King Salman and the crown prince, know exactly what they're doing, adding that some of those they are harshly treating have been milking their country for years.
That indeed may be the case, but there are, of course, many other people, both in Saudi Arabia and among other allies, that have been milking their respective countries with little objections from the Trump administration. In many respects, so what we are seeing in Saudi Arabia may be more comparable to Putin's so-called anti-corruption purges a few years ago, going after various Russian oligarchs who may indeed have been guilty of corrupt practices, but whose major sin was not going along with Putin's agenda. And this may indeed what we're now seeing in Saudi Arabia.
That's Professor Stephen Zunis at the University of San Francisco. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
Thank you. The OA's International Edition continues. President Donald Trump has called on Congress to abolish the Diversity Immigrant Visa Program. It's one that allowed the suspect in last week's deadly New York terror attack to enter the U.S. legally. He called the program a disaster for the country and added it presents significant vulnerabilities to our national security.
I'm going to ask Congress to immediately initiate work to get rid of this program.
Here to discuss is Los Angeles-based immigration attorney Ashkan Amami. First of all, can you explain what this program is, the Diversity Immigrant Visa Program? It's also known as the Green Card Lottery. What's it all about?
Another term for it is the Diversity Visa Lottery Program. So it allows people from countries that have relatively few immigrants to the U.S. to come every year as a part of a randomized lottery system. And the only real requirements are that you have a high school education and some other minor requirements, or you have 2 years in a job that requires some sort of training.
What was the point of this program to begin with?
The point of the program, I think as the name implies, is to sort of encourage diversity in our immigrant population. Mm-hmm. So in countries that don't have a lot of immigrants to the U.S., those countries have higher odds of having an immigrant win the visa lottery and thus get a green card. So they look at the past 5 years. If your country has had more than 50,000 immigrants to the U.S. over the past 5 years, you're not eligible for the visa. So it's countries with less than 50,000 immigrants over the previous five-year period.
There was a Washington immigration attorney that said the idea that somebody could just enter a lottery and effectively become a U.S. citizen, like pulling their name out of a hat, is not a good idea. The president seems to agree. Obviously, he's got some pretty strong opinions about immigration in general here. And now with this person who plowed into all of those people in New York City last week, the president is calling for this program to end. What is your view on that? Do you feel like maybe there could be a better way to do this?
Well, there may be a better way to do it. But I think that my concerns with the lottery have nothing to do with terrorism, because anybody who enters the United States who gets a green card here is subject to the same sorts of background checks and the same sort of scrutiny. The Diversity Visa Lottery does not make it any easier as far as clearing a background check to come to the United States. So I don't think that it's going to solve any security problems to get rid of the lottery. Now, the issue that most people have that I also can sympathize with is that the Diversity Visa Lottery is sort of an unfair to people who have to really, really sort of either wait decades to get a green card, or they have to invest $500,000, or they have to either be sponsored by an employer. I mean, it's very, very difficult to get a green card in the United States, and I think that to have 50,000 of these green cards handed out every year for random people it can feel like it's just a system that's sort of not fairly set up.
This would seem random. This is the first time we're hearing of anybody committing such an act that came into the U.S. because of a program like this. Do you think this is just a random thing, or do you think that a national security is at risk with this program? Or like you said, do you think people are screened enough? And this person may have been radicalized in the United States.
They could have been radicalized in the United States. I think that those who are coming to inflict harm on the United States are not relying on a random visa lottery system to come here. And as you mentioned, I cannot recall any other incidents where a Diversity Visa Lottery recipient winner has committed an act like this. I just think it's any excuse to react against immigration by this administration is one that they will take. I don't think that there's any real security threat associated with this program.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. Los Angeles-based immigration attorney Ashkan Amami. Well, many organizations across the United States sponsor food drives, urging people to contribute canned and non-perishable food for families that are hungry or homeless. And while most campaigns consist of a large box with a donate here sign, an annual design competition in New York City is taking a more creative approach to fighting hunger. Faith Lapidus explains.
It's called Canstruction, And for 25 years, the competition has challenged designers, architects, and engineers to build giant sculptures out of unopened cans of food. This year, 27 teams transformed about 80,000 cans into gravity-defying masterpieces. Studio's architecture's entry pays homage to the competition's 25th year with a sculpture made of red cans of albacore tuna. The top die in Beating the Odds Against Hunger has two white dots, and the bottom one has five dots on each side.
And I think it's just a really pure, simple form, but also has that message of 25 years. And we were able to make it structurally challenging by balancing the one die on a single corner, which actually works in real life, believe it or not. If you play a board game, you can take one die and put it on the dot of the five.
Creating complex three-dimensional shapes that hold together without any glue is a balancing act, and one that requires a steady hand, says Hannah McCarthy of Gase Consulting Engineers, pointing to their pineapple titled Pining to End Hunger.
As you can see with the shell, we've got those openings, so sometimes the cans were falling through. So, you know, we got to sneak back there without knocking anything else over, pulling them back out, putting them back on top. It's a little bit challenging with the leaves. We got to make sure everything's balanced, and then also that we weren't going over our 8-foot mark up at the top.
When the exhibition ends on November 15th, the sculptures will be deconstructed because this is art with a purpose, says Canstruction New York founding member Jennifer Green.
This year in the structures we have, there'll be about 80,000 cans that we donate that will feed 45,000 families. Over the years, and all the constructions, we've donated 50 million pounds of food.
But with one in four New Yorkers hungry, she says, that's like a drop in the bucket. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Signing solidarity with the Cuban people, the United States voted against an annual United Nations resolution condemning the U.S. embargo on Cuba. The resolution was adopted by the General Assembly, with 191 countries voting in favor and two, the United States and Israel, voting against. U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Nikki Haley said the Cuban regime uses the yearly U.N. debate on the U.S. embargo as political theater, a distraction from the destruction it has inflicted on its own people and on others in the Western Hemisphere. Ambassador Haley said, as long as the Cuban people continue to be deprived of their human rights and fundamental freedoms, as long as the proceeds from trade with Cuba go to prop up the dictatorial regime responsible for denying those rights, the United States does not fear isolation in this chamber or anywhere else. Our principles are not up for a vote. She pointed out that those principles are not only enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, but also in the Charter of the United Nations. In her remarks to the General Assembly, Ambassador Haley spoke directly to the Cuban people. She noted that many were hopeful after Cuba and the United States, under the previous administration, opened diplomatic relations between the two countries. What you probably don't know, she said, is that your government responded to this gesture of goodwill not by joining in the spirit in which it was offered, but by expanding its politically motivated detentions, harassment, and violence against those who advocate for political and economic freedom in Cuba. Your government silences its critics, Ambassador Haley declared. It disrupts peaceful assemblies. It censors independent journalists and rigs the economy so the government alone profits. Ambassador Haley emphasized that the American people fully support the Cuban people's dreams of living in a country where freedom of expression is respected and leaders are freely chosen. The United States opposes this resolution today in continued solidarity with the Cuban people and in the hope that they will one day be free to choose their own destiny, said Ambassador Haley. When the day of freedom comes for the Cuban people, and it will come, we will rejoice with them as only a free people can.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.